Good evening, everybody. This is Josh Placer from GameWisdom.com. Welcome to another episode of the Perceptive Podcast. Tonight, we got a great cast for you. We're going to be sticking to a theme tonight, and we're going to be discussing the challenges and considerations that go into physical goods. This is something that we're seeing more and more of thanks to the recent Kickstarter boom of a few years ago, and it's a potentially dangerous area for developers who don't know what they're getting into. There's a lot of interesting hurdles and things you need to think about when preparing to make physical goods, whether you're thinking about something as small as a simple USB drive with your company on it, to actually making like giant products like figurines, posters, clothing, that kind of thing. And for tonight, to help me discuss the challenges of making physical goods, I've asked back one of my returning guests from earlier in 2015. Please welcome from Urban Island Games, game designer, Anthony Conta.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Yeah, it's no problem, Anthony. And again, as we were saying before the cast, definitely Happy New Year. I know we last spoke, I think it was sometime like either early summer or before summer in 2015. So it's been quite a while.
Yeah, it's been a while.
So to get things going then, for people who didn't listen to the previous cast, or just to recap your background with physical goods, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and your studio?
Sure. So Urban Island Games, located in New York, me and a few other people are in the business of making tabletop games. We've forayed a little bit into digital, but mostly tabletop's what we like to make, because it doesn't require programming and you know, a ton of money. The startup. And, you know, we've made a couple of tabletop games. Most recently, we made a deck building game called Emergence Genesis, partnering with several other people to make like a comic hero-y beat 'em up style game, similar to Dominion or Ascension. And then before that, we made a game called Fun Employed, which is a tabletop game about applying to jobs, which is a lot more fun than it sounds like. Promise. It's like a party game. Think Cards Against Humanity, but you get to like apply to silly positions like an astronaut and stuff like that.
And besides doing the tabletop games, you've of course went to Kickstarter. I know Fun Employee was a Kickstarter project. Did you do any other Kickstarter related things?
Oh yeah, Emergence Genesis was also Kickstarter. Yeah, that site, you know, you're speaking a little bit to the boom several years ago. That's how I started. So it was really good.
Cool. So with your day-to-day job at Urban Island Games, you definitely have experience with all aspects of getting your physical goods designed, manufactured, and shipped, of course.
From my brain to your hands. Yep.
Awesome. And that's what we're going to be talking about tonight. And those three sections I just mentioned, that's how we're going to break up this cast. So before we get into our main topic then, Anthony, just to finish wrapping things up with you, how is everything going with Urban Island Games since we last spoke earlier in 2015?
That's great. I think when we spoke last, we were in the midst of getting Emergence printed. We got printed and we fulfilled, I want to say, a month or two late. More on that later. And yeah, our game has been very well received by the people who've played it. Our backers love it. Particularly the Magic the Gathering community has latched onto it because of the connections we have with the developers who are associated with the project. The world was built by Brian David Marshall, who's one of the Pro Tour historians for Magic the Gathering. So, you know, he's been a great asset along with his business partner, Matt Lang. And Fun Employed is doing really well, too. We're in our third print, fourth print, I think, something like that, partnering with Rob Davao there, if you've heard of him.
All right. Yep. Congratulations, Anthony, about that. Are you guys working on any new games or projects at the moment?
Yeah, we've got some more content we're planning for both of those games, expansion material for them, and some other new stuff in the works. But nothing to announce yet.
Awesome. All right. It's definitely great to hear, Anthony. And so I think with that, let's get to our big topic. And again, that is going to be talking about physical goods and what goes into them. As I said a few minutes ago, The use of physical goods have always been a popular option in the video game industry. Again, I get to date myself remembering the days of giant thick manuals, boxes, all those fancy collector's editions. Today, most of the time, you're going to get a collector's edition from like a big name studio like Blizzard, or like just like a deluxe pack from someone like a AAA company. The use of physical goods has always helped sell games. I think it's always great to have that tangible product in your hand, and especially if you're doing something with tabletop games such as Urban Island Games. The tabletop industry has also flourished thanks to physical goods, and even with online play, it's still great to get cards in your hand, sit around a table with friends, and enjoy things that way. With Kickstarter and crowdfunding, we've seen physical goods expand into a form of rewards for games. And with all the different Kickstarters out there, we've seen so many varied products. As I said earlier, like USB drives, we've seen t-shirts, paper dioramas, soundtracks, even like crazy stuff like giant statues, figurines, etc. And all these items are made explicitly with the purpose to get you to pledge or to get you to up your pledge and get something special. It's why it's become a very attractive option for Kickstarters and crowdfunding campaigns. But the problem, though, is that if you don't properly plan your physical goods out, either in the areas of the design, the manufacturing, or the filament, it can come back to bite your wallet very bad. And we've seen a lot of examples of this through Kickstarter and horror stories from developers who get in over their heads with not properly preparing for this. I know when we spoke earlier in 2015, I think we sort of touched on this topic and you went into a little bit about the challenges of making physical goods.
Yeah. The biggest challenge isn't actually how much it costs to make the good. Mm-hmm. It's how much it costs to get the good from point A to point B. Mm-hmm. Shipping is ridiculous. It's really expensive.
Oh, yeah. I've been trying to sell stuff like from Amazon and even just like selling small stuff. The shipping prices have gone up, and I can't even begin to imagine what it's like if you're trying to print out an actual tabletop game or even any one of the number of physical goods I just mentioned, like shirts, figurines, etc.
Yeah, I mean, I can give you an example from Emergence. Sure. We budgeted $6 for shipping because at the time it was, you know, reasonable. Mm-hmm. Fast forward almost a year when shipping prices change and our fulfillment companies change. Now we're spending $14.
$14 like an item, I guess, or
product? An item. Ooh. That's right. Yeah. So so our Kickstarter profits got hit a little bit hard. Mm-hmm. Luckily, it's not a problem now. But, you know, fulfillment itself was quite a challenge. I mean, mm-hmm. you're giving a t-shirt to someone and you think, oh, it costs $15 to make a t-shirt. Great. I'll sell it for $20. Mm-hmm. But you don't, you know, you got to factor in the price to get it from A to B and your time.
Yeah.
To write all those labels.
Definitely. And we'll be talking about the challenges of filming later on in the cast.
Yeah.
To get the ball rolling, then we're going to start with the earliest stage. And that is actually coming up with the goods you want to actually make in the first place. Now, I guess for you, Anthony, when you're actually, like, designing your tabletop games, are you at the same time thinking about, like, what kind of, like, how is this going to come out, like, when it's all set and manufactured? Or when does the actual thinking up the design of your physical goods come into play?
I'd say the physical good design doesn't really come in until we're getting closer to do some sort of, like, crowdfunding or... it's something along those lines. The thing about it is I don't want like shipping weight to affect my concepts or mm-hmm. prototypes, my original designs. Like if I mm-hmm. make a game that uses heavy metal figurines, you know, I'll worry about the cost later and price the product appropriately. I'm not going to let that come in at the start of my idea. Mm-hmm. But you know, I tend to design towards cards mm-hmm. because cards are cheap to make yeah. and easy to make. Like this is hard to mess up a cart. It's possible and it's happened to yeah. me. But it's hard. So that's kind of where I like think about making physical products.
Yeah, I can understand that. Same thing with like game design. You don't want to start getting bogged down by the minutiae early on in development. You want to have something concrete and playable before you start thinking along those lines.
Yeah, custom things also are synonymous with the word expensive.
Yes, yes, they are.
Because molds are expensive. Mm-hmm. We actually made a really cool product for one of ours. We had these like figurines that this guy Vernon just like sculpts for a living. He like takes discarded other figurines and repurposes them to make custom figures, but they're expensive. They're very expensive, and shipping is too for them. But more on fulfillment later.
Yeah. Now, in terms of like the quality of like the product used, I know, at least from my base understanding, there is different qualities of paper, different qualities of like paint, ink, and stuff like that. Do you think about that level of detail during this design phase, or is that something that comes in later on when you're talking to manufacturers?
Oh, from day one, when we knew we were making a deck building game, we knew that we wanted the highest quality cards because they're very important for a type of game where you're shuffling and shuffling and shuffling and shuffling, 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 shuffling. A lot of cards are moving around. So we made sure that that was like where we were at the start of it. We knew that we wanted cards that good. So we investigated, we found the difference between ivory core, black core, gray core, what all these different things mean as far as the strength and durability of a card, the weight of a card, whether it's, you know, GSM, whatever that weight may be, you know, all those other things. We don't really think about like color because, you know, 15 years ago, color printers and inks, it was more expensive, but the technology's caught up to where the color of your physical goods isn't really going to be that different as if you did it in black and white. So there's no reason to be concerned about that, but there are a lot of different options you have for the quality of your paper and the quality of the cards you may choose.
Yeah. And the same also goes for any kind of figures you make, any kind of like the different quality, like the pewter figurines and stuff like that. As we just said a few minutes ago, these things are generally made custom, and custom equals expensive in a lot of cases.
Yeah. If you're going to make like dice to include, if you have like some sort of, like if Armello had shipped, custom dice that were physical, you know, they don't necessarily need to make like a 5-sided die for some obscure reason. They could just use a mold that exists for a 6-sided die and change one of the faces. That's a cheaper way of like saving some cost, but still having a custom product. So thinking of ways to kind of fit the mold, but break it at the same time, or alter the mold really will help you save cost on your custom products.
Yeah. Now, as we said a few minutes ago, during your design phase of creating your tabletop game, you're not thinking about the physical, excuse me, the physical goods side of things. Now, later in the development, when you start thinking about these physical goods side, has there been any examples or cases where thinking about the physical good had to, or in some case, impact the actual game design, or has both areas remained pretty much separate?
Yeah, we've been thinking about our game design being impacted by the physical side a little bit, more so for an art restriction. So we've got a couple ideas right now where we want to, you know, expand one of our games. And the art burdens that are required for expanding it, like drawing a bunch of extra cards for a specific character, are kind of burdening us a little bit. So that's sort of like a, not really a physical good problem. It's part physical good, but part digital good, where we have to pay an artist to draw like 5 more cards. But those 5 more cards are going to be more expensive than if we didn't do that. So can we make it without needing that? So that's kind of like a real world restriction that's impacting our designs.
Now, another part of getting these physical goods designed and manufactured, I just want to ask, just to clarify, besides doing the tabletop and specifically the card side of things, Anthony, have you done anything with other physical goods, like either something as simple as like t-shirts, clothing, or like the figurines that we talked about earlier?
Yeah, I did some figurines. We did figurines for Emergence Genesis because we had characters that had really good art for that. For Fun Employed, we actually got a little creative for our rewards. We made it job themed. So what we did was for the first print run of the game, if you're a backer, you get a special slip in your game. and it says an organization chart. So for, you know, any company, they'll have an org chart for who gets what title. And we had a title called manager, which was just pledging for the game. And this was a an org chart that everyone got if they got a physical copy of the first print run of Fun Employed's rebrand. but we offered people an option to spend $5 more to be a senior manager. And all that meant was that on that little piece of paper, your name would be above everyone else under a senior manager title. And we had a good amount of conversion for that. We were really surprised. Nothing's changed. You're not getting a different game. You're not getting a different experience. You are just higher up on your piece of paper that everyone gets to see. And, you know, I think creative rewards like that, that kind of sidestep making more physical goods. We specifically didn't make buttons or t-shirts or hats or whatever else, things that we could have made very easily because it's an extra product that you have and you have to ship and you have to figure out. So we were in the Kickstarter business of kickstarting one product and trying to add as much value to that product with our reward tiers and stretch goals. Having to manage a whole other item is a whole other part of your process. It's almost like you're making it two goods. And that's stressful and hard.
And especially, as you just said, with each new physical good, it adds, you know, a whole nother product to think about design, think about how much it's going to cost to make, how much it's going to cost to manufacture, and as we said earlier, how much it's going to cost to ship. Because obviously, things of different size, different weight, that all gets factored into shipping around the world.
Yeah. Oh, worldwide shipping's really expensive to, to ship a physical game of one of ours to Australia. At one point, it was $60. I think it still might be $60 now. It's a lot.
Oh, yes, it is. I know, as a brief tangent, I know that Australia's definitely had issues with regional pricing, not just with tabletop games, but we've seen this with a lot of digital games as well. I've seen like people say that like a $50 game in the U.S. is like $80 or $90, maybe even more than that in Australia.
Yeah, just to ship Fun Employed, it costs 2.5 times what the game we sell for. That's why having a digital version, this was important to us during our campaign, having a print and play for these countries that don't want to pay $100 for a game that costs $25.
Yeah, and that was definitely a smart move on your part. Again, super, it gets around, or it's a creative get around the physical limitations or the physical challenges that could have upset things otherwise.
Yeah. Now, what I do love for these like rewards for creating like physical goods are one of items that are like really, really exclusive that are going to bring some people out that really love your game. So imagine during like Shovel Knight's campaign, if they had 10 or one or two of each figurines of like each boss in that game and Shovel Knight himself, like that would have been really cool, right? Like $500 for that. Sure. Maybe that costs $100 to make, but that's an extra $400 that you know, you're getting support from, and that $100 is going to get you, you know, far enough into making that one of custom figure for a friend or a contact you might have, and shipping it.
Yeah, and it's an interesting point about that, about having those super one-off items. When I spoke with Greg Johnson from Human Nature Studios, who's working on Toe Jim and Earl, the remake of that, he talked about how they plan a lot of specifically one-off items. They had got like pewter figurines made up, and they limited the number, so they knew exactly how much they were going to make. And that actually takes me to another question I want to ask you about, Anthony. When you're thinking about like things from like a Kickstarter, like a reward level, or even when you're thinking about design, actually, let's stick to rewards. When you're thinking about rewards and setting up how much you want someone to buy or how many products you have available, do you think there is a major difference between having a goal that is, let's say, it's an infinite goal, as long as people keep buying it, you're going to keep producing it, versus saying, we will make 500 of this, no more, no less. When it's up, it's gone. We're not going to make any more of that.
Yeah, I'm not a huge fan of capping content to Kickstarter campaigns. Like, let's say, you know, to use them again because I love them, Shovel Knight had capped their DLC to only backers. Mm-hmm. That would feel really bad to people who discover the game and they really want to support it more. So I hate exclusive Kickstarter stuff. But if you get a promo for backing it for free and then that promo is available for sale later, or that item, whatever mm-hmm. it may be, like a little figurine that's available later for sale, I like that a lot more. I hate the idea of not being able to get something later mm-hmm. as a backer.
Yeah. And we've seen this with a lot of digital games, especially those that go from Kickstarter to early access. When you have the early access crowd viewing these games for the first time, who may not have ever heard of your game before, and they see you had all this great exclusive stuff, and it's like, hey, I really love your game, but can I get it? And you say, no, it was only for the Kickstars. They're going to feel generally pissed because they had no idea you even had that option available.
Yeah, you don't want to like alienate people who just were late to the party. Mm-hmm. I'm okay with it if it's cosmetic. Mm-hmm. So like, you know, if you had this game on early access and you're like, you're playing in the game and it's like a skin mm-hmm. and you can only get it for pre-order bonus or whatever. Like, sure. Well, fine. That's okay, I guess. But if it's content that affects your ability to play the game, mm-hmm. Like if it were a level or like mm-hmm. an expansion that you can't get anywhere else or like additional characters, that would make me feel a lot worse.
Yeah, and I'm happy you just said exclusive characters, Anthony, because that actually brings up a really good example of what happens when you run into the situation. With Darkest Dungeon from Red Hook Games, they kind of ran into a little bit of a stumbling block with their Kickstarter pledges. During the Kickstarter campaign, they had said that if you pledge, I think, $30 or more to the game, you would get a Kickstarter exclusive variant of one of the character classes in the game. Now, at that time, they didn't give any specifics, obviously, but for people who would pledge only during the Kickstarter, they would get this exclusive variant. And as we just said, what happened was that when the game went to early access and everyone was like, oh my god, this game's amazing, I want to play it, you got something exclusive I want to try out, they said, oh, but this was only for people who pledged to us during the Kickstarter. And specifically, people who pledged $30 or more. And it rubbed people the wrong way because, again, this was exclusive content. Now, I believe it's mostly aesthetics, but it's still a unique character that you won't see otherwise, even, you know, from this point unto eternity, unless they decide to change their minds and make it like DLC or something, which, at the time of this cast, I don't know for sure. They've been hemming and hawing about how this is going to play out. I don't think the class is going to be ready for launch. It will come later on. So there is still time for them to, you know, put their foot down on the matter. But this was kind of like a small stain on an otherwise flawless Kickstarter campaign.
Yeah, I like that game too. Now I'm kind of sad.
Yeah, and
I was waiting for it to come to Vita.
I think it is going to come at some point.
Oh, man. I'm so excited. Love my Vita.
Oh, yeah. I have a friend, too, who loves it, too. I think Jason McMaster from Quarter 3, he's talking about the Vita, too. I still need to get that at some point. I have, like, the old school PSP.
It's a die-hard install base. Like, from what I've heard, like, if you like a Vita, you love your Vita.
Nice.
If you like it, which is rare.
Mm-hmm. And with Darkest Dungeon, I love the game too. I am, at this point, I'm like rubbing my hands in anticipation for the game to be released on January 19th. I am so ready.
Oh, that's really soon.
I know. I am so ready to jump into that game. For those of you listening to the cast, and this cast may either come out before or after the Darkest Dungeon's release, but I can tell you for sure that day one, I will be playing that game.
We just don't see you for like another month. There's just like a month gap in your podcast.
Yeah, I may have to call in to work and say, oh, I'm not feeling so good. I come down with an affliction.
Yeah.
All right, getting back to talking about the design of things. As we've said a few minutes ago regarding deciding what kind of goods to have. So when we start getting into like heavy items or the premium stuff, you know, custom t-shirts. One of the Kickstarters I saw was from Harebrained Schemes who did Battletech. They actually had like, I think it was like leather jackets or some kind of like very fancy jackets made up. When you get to that level of goods, you know, the stuff that's going to cost several hundred dollars, do you think at that point it's good to have a hard limit, or do you still want to leave some room open for people later on?
I mean, I would never make that good in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Just because, well, I mean, like, that's such a customizable good. Like, so I'm going to wear a leather jacket, but maybe I'm a larger in XL. If my, you know, wife wanted that, she'd be like a medium or small women's. Like, how many of those do you have to make for it to be profitable? That seems really hard to have a store for that. Now you're a clothing manufacturer and you're not a game designer. Like, what, what do you, what do you want to be? Right. I think people can be a little bit, if they're willing to push their creativity, which they should be as designers, they can probably get away with not doing as many physical goods, or at least goods that are that crazy.
Yeah. And one final question I have, at least for this section for you, anything that I'm curious about, again, with keeping with the whole supplies section that we're talking about, when you're like actually preparing like to get these physical goods and you're thinking about them from a design and manufacturing standpoint, do you order, like, I guess to phrase it, do you know at this stage how many of these goods you're going to need to get printed up and everything? Or do you almost, like, ballpark and give yourself a little wiggle room down the line?
It depends on the good. For the figures, we made, you know, we knew we were going to make, like, one of each figure specifically. If we were to, like, make a bunch of you know, mass-produced figurines or some custom dice or something, we would make, you know, enough so that we weren't losing money on it for whatever Kickstarter we did. But then we wouldn't make it a Kickstarter exclusive. We'd make it a promo item that they get for free, and then we could sell that promo later so that we don't have to print 500. We give it to our 100 Kickstarter backers who wanted it, and then we have 400 just sitting around. So I think that answers the question. Does it?
I think so. And that actually takes me to that, gives me a little bit of a spring for another question for you. One area that we haven't really talked about is actually holding these physical goods or storing them. When you get these manufactured and shipped, do you like keep them on premises? Do you keep them stored like at your fulfillment center? Like, where do they like normally just like sit when you're waiting for someone to buy them?
Depends on the good. And depends on the project, actually. So for Fun Employed, we had about, at one point, I want to say, 100 cases, which is 400 games, just sitting in someone's garage. Because he had a big house and his kids had moved out for college, so they were just sitting there. So that was our storage and fulfillment facility for a little while. But we've partnered with companies now that, you know, either ship them to Amazon and they stay there, or we partner with ACD for our other game, Emergence, to, you know, they just buy it from the store and they have warehouses. So it really depends on your good. If you got a big house and you want to do it all yourself, then by all means, toss it in your basement, put it in a bedroom. I got like a bunch of cases of Fun Employed in my bedroom right now.
Cool. All right. Before we move on to our next section then, Anthony, to wrap up talking about the design part of a physical good, I guess first, were there any areas or challenges that I didn't mention that you would like to bring up now?
If you're going to design a physical good, I guess I'll say make it as light as possible and make it as flat as possible. I love it when I get a board game or, you know, any other physical good that fits into a USPS box perfectly. I know that is a person who thought a lot about how they were going to get something from point A to point B, and their design is reflected in that. It's brilliant. I love that. I love, you know, I guess it's like the Tetris-y nature in me where it fits perfectly too. But I've had packages just arrive. It fits perfectly in my mailbox and in the package that it came in, and I just open it up and every single inch of design space is used intelligently. Not necessarily full, but intelligently used. I guess one of the best examples of that right now is Exploding Kittens is perfectly like designed for moving from one place to another. And they had a nice little interesting thing that was in their box for the first edition It's using real estate that wouldn't be used otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And when you open it, it's a little electronic chip that meows at you.
Nice.
It's adorable, and it's only for the first edition print, and it uses the space that sits adjacent to the rules, that space is empty for all other editions of the game.
Cool, and again, goes back to what you were saying earlier about coming up with creative solutions to maximize your creativity without maximizing your costs.
Yeah, it's just a nice little throw-in that they had. It was, you know, really light, and it's unique and interesting.
Yeah, and it's not like it added to the shipping cost, it didn't add to the design of the packaging. You just said it's in a spot that would have been normally empty. So they were just using that space that would have otherwise just been blank for everyone else.
Yeah, exactly.
Cool.
It's perfect.
And I guess that may have sort of answered this question, but I just want to ask it to you, Anthony. For any developers or anyone listening to this cast who's thinking about doing their own physical goods, are there any major red flags or pitfalls at this like production stage that you would like advise them to keep an eye out for?
I would just, you know, make sure you, when you're designing your items, have thought about how they're going to be used and how they're going to be transported from one place to another for a physical good. For a digital good, it kind of just sits there in the aether.
Mm-hmm.
But for a physical good, someone's wearing that item or someone's putting it on their shelf or someone's carrying it to their friend's house. So it's just good to think about how they're going to use it.
Okay. With that, let's move on to our next section. And this is, of course, manufacturing. So you've already came up with the design. You have it all set up. You may even have an actual physical prototype on hand. Now it's time to actually get it printed, get it created, so that you can start fulfilling your orders and ideally making some money. Now, manufacturing, this is an area that it's definitely out of my wheelhouse. It's one that I have not really thought about, again, as someone who doesn't do this on a day-to-day basis. So I'm really curious to get your insights into this, Anthony, because as we said earlier in the cast, from all areas of the physical goods side, this is sort of your bread and butter and what you do at Urban Island.
Yeah. So if you're making a physical good, it's going to sound a little basic at first, but Google's really good at finding places for you to make it.
Mm-hmm.
What I used was I started, you know, Google search.
Mm-hmm.
How do I make playing cards? And from playing cards, because I knew a playing card manufacturer would be able to just make cards in general. And from there, I found several very, very various resources that are very valuable. One of which was, I forget his exact name, but some guy who's very, very big in the Kickstarter community, and he's made a bunch of different tabletop games. James Math, I believe his name is, and he had a resource of a list of people who made playing cards game and all sorts of other sorts of board game manufacturers. So for about, I want to say, 6 months, a year, I would, you know, look for these types of lists, and I would go to conventions to try to find people who made games. The nice thing about the East Coast is there's a ton of conventions that you can go to for digital and physical games. PAX East, Boston FIG, a bunch of others. But those are the two biggest ones that I went to. Indiecade is another one, Indiecade East. And there were board game manufacturers, and I would talk to them and ask them about these types of things. So if you're trying to make a physical product, not only searching online, which I'm sure all of this audience is aware of, but also if there are any conventions where you are and someone has your physical product, you can ask them, how'd you make that? If they're a publisher, or not publisher, a manufacturer, you can ask them about that. They're very receptive to people talking to them about their games. That might apply more for board games than physical goods that accompany a digital game.
Mm-hmm.
But that's how I found mine and my manufacturers that I like very much.
Okay. Now, I'm not sure if you had any experience in this next question, Anthony, but have you done any, as we said earlier, with like specialized goods? We're talking like clothing, figurines, stuff like that. Have you done like any research or work with manufacturers on those types of products in the past?
Yeah, I've asked about some of that stuff. We have our manufacturer, I guess he's more of a custom guy than like a guy with a plant.
Mm-hmm.
But I've asked, you know, one of our manufacturers with a plant about some other goods that we could go into. And they have, you know, good connections. Their stuff's made in China. Mm-hmm. And they have like a t-shirt connection where it costs like maybe 40 cents a shirt, which was really cheap. Mm-hmm. But, you know, shipping is a lot of that.
Yeah.
To get it from China to here and then from here or wherever you are. And then from wherever you are to wherever it needs to go is going to cost a lot.
Mm-hmm. Now, as a stupid question for me, when we're talking about these manufacturers, are most of them like outside the United States or are there United States manufacturers as well?
Probably depends on the good. Okay. There are several plants for – I know the most about cards. Mm-hmm. So I'll speak mostly to card games or card products. A lot's in China. Mm-hmm. That's where Cards Against Humanity gets printed. That's where Exploding Kittens, I believe, was printed. There's a couple in the U.S. I believe the U.S. prints – the board game publishers in the U.S. sometimes have their own facilities where they print, and you can't really get a quote from them because they're board game makers. They're not going to like make games for you and let you sell your games. Mm-hmm. That's not what they're publishers. Mm-hmm. So the publishers have their own plants, but there's some plants in the U.S. that you can print from. I believe the cheapest prices are in China and Europe, though that may have changed. And there are a few boutique manufacturers that take these Kickstarter games and do small print runs of them.
Mm-hmm.
Which you could also just do a small print run of cards with them for your digital game as an accompaniment. So they're all around the world.
Okay. Now, when you're talking to these manufacturers, you said a few minutes ago that they are generally very well receptive. For like someone like brand new or someone with their first Kickstarter project, their first like tabletop game, whatever, do they have any trouble with getting their like foot in the door of these places? Like, do you need to have some kind of pre-established credibility or resume before they would even talk to you?
No, you don't even need to meet them. You can just email them and get quotes from them. No one knew who I was.
Okay.
And I said, hey, here's a game that I'd like to print. And, you know, it's in their interest to want to talk to you because them printing stuff makes them money.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, they'd like to print bigger products because you have bigger clients, which means they print more, but they're making money on the games that they print, the things that they print for you. So they definitely want to talk to you. It might take them a little while to, mm-hmm. to get to you because they have a backlog because of the Kickstarter boom.
Mm-hmm.
But they're absolutely interested in talking to you.
All right. And speaking about talking to them, when you're like presenting your game or your product to these manufacturers, what are like some like standard details that you want to bring up or you want to tell them about when you're asking for a quote from them?
So the manufacturers don't really care about the design.
Mm-hmm.
They care about what you need to make it. So what you have to tell them is the physical materials that you need. So if you need a box with some cards in it and maybe a piece of paper that describes what's in the box, whether that be a rule book or an art book or whatever it may be, a mm-hmm. Piece of paper that describes what it is, that's all you really need to say. You need to say the size of the box you want. You need to be specific about your dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
So like, what's your box size? What's your card size? What's your card weight? What's your card quality? What type of finish do you want on your cards? There's a bunch of different finishes, whether you have like a flat finish or like a linen finish, which feels a little bit ribbed.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, you want to know those dimensions and those specifics. You're not really going to have those sort of things like weight and feel for a box itself.
Mm-hmm.
But they want, you know, those other things.
Okay. Now, when you're actually doing like the manufacturing, do they handle any area of like design, like coming up with box art or coming up with like the font, or is all that handled from you, which you basically relay to them to manufacture?
You'd make the design files.
Okay.
So, you know, you get Photoshop or Illustrator or whatever, and they give you a template. They're very nice,
mm-hmm.
Depending upon who you go through. But they give you a template and says, okay, here's your template. You have to make sure that your bleed is okay because there has to be a little bit of bleed when you print the product because not every printing mm-hmm. is perfect.
Yeah.
So you make sure there's a safe zone where none of your content is. You print it and you know, you
design it all yourself in your in your computer design program of choice. And yeah, you have to do all of that. I mean, they're willing to help you, depending upon, again, the manufacturer, because that's just a part of good customer service if no one's ever done that before. And for us, we hadn't done that. We needed templates from them, so we got the templates. But you're responsible for it in the end, and you get like a proof of what it is.
Okay. Now, when you're dealing with the manufacturer, do you give them like a timeline or a time frame saying, I need this done in so-and-so, or do they generally tell you, okay, we'll have this done in 6 months or 3 months? Or I guess as a follow-up to that question, is there like a standard turnaround time from the manufacturer?
It depends on the manufacturer's load. So if you're a plant in China and you approach them in January, you're probably not getting your product for a while because of Chinese New Year. If you approach them in the summer, then yeah, you'll probably get your product a bit sooner. Unless summer is a bad time for the holidays. I think fall is the bad time for the holidays, depending upon where you are. But it depends on when you approach them. I think the way it works is you say, I have this thing, when can I get it from you by? And they're like, okay, you can get it from this time. Because that's how long it takes. And if you rush it, you can. That costs more.
Of course, yes.
You know, much like, you know, any other thing or place you buy from. But yeah, they kind of control when you'll see it.
Now, in terms of, like, as you said earlier, with getting, like, your list of different manufacturers and shopping around, are there any, like, key traits or details you look at specifically when deciding what manufacturer to go to?
Yeah, a lot of it is kind of just a vibe thing. Like, what is the, what am I getting from this manufacturer? Like, how do I feel when I'm with them? A lot of it's also price. Like, if you can print 500 cards for $5,000 at one place, and this other place can print 500 cards for $1,000, then, you know, I'm probably going to go for the cheaper option. Prices don't vary too greatly because it's, you know, homogenous product, at least, again, for cards. This could be very different for pewter figurines, which may be a smaller market than paper. But it's hard to have the price of that product vary greatly because it's so homogenous. So if someone's saying, you know, I'll do your entire project for $12,000, someone else says $10,000, that's a big factor. But also the customer service for when I'm dealing with these people, the way that they talk in emails. There's a variety of factors.
Okay.
Those are the big ones.
All right. Now, another stupid question for you, Anthony. As you just said with the pricing, it's usually kept somewhat within the same ballpark for everyone because it's a homogenous product. Is there like any kind of like negotiations, or do they basically say, we'll do it for this amount of price and that's it? Like, you can like try to say, could you give me a better offer or anything like that?
I mean, you could try it. I don't think it'll work.
Okay.
But you could certainly try to haggle with them. But like, it's weird haggling over this type of material. I feel like I'm not going to go to the deli and pick up a Coke and be like, hey, how much is this? It's $1.25. I wish in New York. It's $1.25. Well, how about a dollar? Like, I'm not going to haggle with them about it. I'll just get a quote from somewhere else and go for the best quote. Like, if you could do it for cheaper and your competition is doing it for cheaper, then you're just going to be run out of business. Right. So I feel that in the long run, those types of prices will even themselves out.
Okay. Now, another question, one thing that I've always heard about shipping and when it comes to physical goods, I'm sorry, about manufacturing them, is that there's usually a price break. The more you order, the cheaper it is. Is that?
Yes.
Okay. I just want to make sure that is still true and all that.
And, you know, cheaper per unit. So it's not like, oh, I get 1,000 now, it costs me somehow less money. It's per unit.
Yes.
So the more of a good you make, if you make one item, they have to set up the press and fire it up for that one item. When the press is already fired up, you make more, and it's suddenly cheaper because, you know, you don't have that initial setup thing.
Okay. Now, when you're shopping around to these manufacturers, do they give you like an idea of like a limit of how much or how little of a product they're willing to make, or is it that they're willing to take whatever you're looking to manufacture?
They're not going to print 10 copies of something, mm-hmm. probably, if it's cards.
Yeah.
Like, general minimum print runs have been around 500 to 1,000, depending upon who you go to.
Mm-hmm.
I will add a caveat to that in a moment, but there's no ceiling. Like, if you want to buy a million of something, I'm sure they'll sell you a million of something.
Mm-hmm.
The caveat to all this is the Game Crafter, which is a specific website. And I think there might be another version of it, but the same service. It might be unique. The Game Crafter is a place where you can just do short print runs of like 10 copies, one copy. It's excellent for prototypes of any physical game that I can think of. It's got dice and cards and everything else. So I used those to make some prototypes for Fun Employed, before we did our Kickstarter. That place is it's pretty good. It's a bit expensive because, you know, you're printing 10 of something instead of what people would normally print thousands of or hundreds of. So your per unit cost is pretty high.
Okay. Now, here's a question. Again, this one I'm not sure if you've had experience with this or not, but I am generally curious about. When you have a board game that's made up of different physical goods, so you have the actual board, you have dice, you have figures, you have cards, the whole thing, does one manufacturer handle all aspects of the physical goods creation, or do you need like several ones, each specializing in a certain area or a certain type of good?
Depends on what you want. If you have pretty standard things in your experience, your game, your product, whatever it is, it'll probably be just one.
Mm-hmm.
So if you had like dice and cards and board, most of that's just game supplies and paper, which many manufacturers will be able to put into one product for you and shrink wrap it and everything. I can't imagine ordering figures from one place, cards from another, and dice from a third, than having them all be put together. Because someone has to put that together.
Yes.
And that someone's probably you.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to shrink wrap. That sounds... You're no longer a designer. Mm-hmm. You're a manufacturing... You're shipping and logistics.
Yeah. Another part I'm curious about, going back to the actual like number of goods you're getting manufactured, if, like, let's say you order 1,000 copies of your tabletop game, and then 5-6 months down the line, you're starting to run out of that supply. When you go back to that manufacturer, do they give you a different quote? Does anything change if you're going back to someone for like a second or a third printing?
It's probably it depends on the manufacturer.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they can, they probably give you the same quote, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
The setup fees, generally just a couple $100, and it's probably rolled in. So it probably depends on the manufacturer, but in my experience, it could be the same.
Okay. To start to wrap up this section, I was wondering, Anthony, could you give, like, for people listening who are curious about this side of things, is there like a general price? Like, let's say someone wants to print up 1,000 units of their tabletop game. Do you have like a ballpark figure what something like that would cost, just talking from a manufacturing side right now?
Yeah, it's probably impossible just because it would depend on what the game is. Like if it's 52 cards or 104 cards, or if there are dice or if there's a board, like it varies so high. I mean, I've seen board games that cost 10, board games that cost 80.
Yeah.
And board games that cost 200. So
I believe you on that. I remember looking at a lot of the Kickstarters for tabletop games, and some of those have like when they got those stretch goals, they must have had like hundreds of figurines and cards and different boards and expansions. And those Kickstarters had like huge pledges, but I'm going to definitely assume that they probably have a huge amount of cost to get all that manufactured, designed, and fulfilled. Now, to wrap up this section then for you, Anthony, just as I said in the previous one, for designers and people listening to this cast right now, are there any major traps or red flags they need to watch out for during the manufacturing side of things?
Just make sure that you've done a cost analysis scenario for various different levels of your good. So let's say we're only printing 500. Well, if we only sell 500, is our price per unit set appropriately? So like, just made up example, like if it costs $10 to make 500, but $5 to make 1,000, you don't price it at 750, because if you sell 500, then you're spending $10 per item, but you've charged 750 per item. So you need to make sure you price it at a level that even at your lowest print run, you don't lose out. So for that item, I would probably say $15 for this add-on. And if 1,000 people back it, that's a great amount of profit you get, and that's awesome. But you also have to now send it to 1,000 people.
Yeah.
Instead of 500 or whatever else.
Okay. And this next question, I'm not sure this actually fits with manufacturing or leads into fulfillment, but talking about the actual price per unit, when you're actually saying, okay, this is going to be a $20 reward, or this is going to be $15, at what part of the development of the physical goods do you start thinking about price and selling it to the consumer?
Probably when I'm thinking about making it.
Okay.
I would ask how much it is, and then they would tell me, and then I'd price it appropriately.
Okay.
And then I'd put it up on Kickstarter, I guess.
All right. And when you're coming up with the pricing for it based on the manufacturing, you're also taking into shipping in account at this point, right?
Oh, yeah. I take shipping into account from this almost start of the project.
Okay. All right, and I think that's a good lead into our final topic then. All right, we're going to move on to then our final topic then, and the one that I'm sure you've had a lot of experience with and probably had a lot of nightmares about, and that is fulfillment.
A couple of restless nights.
Now, for those of you listening, when we talk about fulfillment, this is the act of getting the good to your consumer. So you've come up with a design, you've got a manufacturer, you have cases of it sitting in your garage or your bedroom, whatever, and now it's time to get it in the hands of the people who spent the money. So for you, Anthony, when we start talking about fulfillment, what's like the first step or the first thing you think about when trying to get these goods to your consumers?
I'm wrong. Like, whatever I think the price is, it's just wrong. Like, it's just five times more expensive. Like, I know I'm being a bit hyperbolistic, but shipping is a drastically changing market. Like, if you price out something and then, like, 6 months later, its price has probably changed. So whenever I think about getting the product to consumers, I also, you know, should be thinking, well, the manufacturer has to get the product to me. So it's important to think about shipping on multiple levels.
Yes.
Not just to your consumers, but to you from your producer. There are a variety of factors that you need to think about with shipping, but that's, you know, one of the big ones.
Now, as you just said, with getting the goods from the manufacturer, earlier you talked about you have like your own fulfillment center that's also handling things now. When you're getting goods from the manufacturer, do you have them generally shipped to the fulfillment center, or do they always get shipped to you and then you have to get them to the fulfillment center?
It depends on the good. It depends on the project. I think we normally send them to the fulfillment center. So for Funemployed, we made it in China. It went to a dock through customs. So like, you know, like a pier, like the actual docks. And then from there, someone had to take it and give it to the fulfillment company that drove a truck to the docks, and then they bring it to their warehouse. That all requires logistics. Now, our printer was nice enough to do all that for us, to manage that aspect of it. But even then, that aspect got, you know, a bit convoluted, because we're telling them that they got to go do something and connect with the third party, but then the third party disconnects with them. So like, that was an opportunity for a problem to happen, and it did.
And again, as we were saying a few minutes ago, this is definitely where the logistics and managing everything really comes into play in order to not get yourself screwed on any part. I think when we spoke earlier in the summer, I think you mentioned like a brief horror story you had with getting some goods shipped from overseas. I think there was like a strike or something that affected the time of when the goods would arrive.
Yeah, that's right. There was a what's it called? A labor union strike. Like, so the people who like take things off from the docks, they're doing more than just board games. They're taking off like T-shirts or you know whatever you're importing into the U.S. customs agents. And they just said, nope, we want better working conditions or whatever they said. And they were on strike. So that meant that all these crates and containers at the docks were just stuck there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, your goods are held hostage. And this isn't just for Kickstarter. It's for everyone who imported something. And that caused a backlog that was a problem. You know, that's kind of a delay that I think people can be okay with. Mm-hmm. You know, because it's not really a project management delay. It's just kind of like...
the way the world works, almost.
Yeah, like a freak of nature accident. That doesn't happen too often, I don't think. But, you know, that's certainly a risk that can happen, for sure.
All right. Now, for people listening to this cast right now, are there any major benefits doing the fulfillment from your end as opposed to dealing with a fulfillment center?
Cost. So, it basically comes down to time versus money. If you have all the time in the world, which you probably don't, then you can do it yourself. Or if it's really easy for you to do. So this is where the design of the product intersects with fulfillment, where you design something specifically to be fulfilled easily. I know a couple of tabletop designers who made a game, and that game was so small that it could fit into a regular envelope. And you just drop that in your mailbox. You know, you don't have to go to the post office even. And that's a game that they made. It was a playable experience in a little tiny mailbox envelope, which is awesome. So like that type of game, you don't need a fulfillment center for. You just need to get all the games sent to you. It's really light. It probably fits in like 2 or 3 boxes. And then you can send it to 1,000 people. You got to buy a lot of stamps and write a lot of letters, but that's a lot easier than trying to mail someone a board game with all these different figures all across the country, let alone the world, if you decide to go international. So it really depends on the scope of your project. I've been very much in love with the idea of designing a game that's like 15 cards and can fit into a little tiny envelope that can go to people without any sort of fulfillment company required. So it really depends. That's where I say the design comes in and why I think about shipping from the start. Of when I'm making a game.
Yeah. And again, as we were talking about earlier in the cast, when you get to like very awkward or heavy packages or heavy games, that quickly adds up the cost. I know even trying to ship like small things like books and video games, like just through like a simple post office, every pound will drastically increase the cost of shipping that. And not only that, but as you just said, if you're shipping around the world or, you know, further in the United States, stuff like that, every place has its own different shipping costs.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we said that shipping it from point A to point B, we thought would be $6, but we didn't check every single area code or, you know, postal code. And it wasn't $6 everywhere. And, you know, that hurt us a little bit. It wasn't detrimental, but, you know, maybe your project blows up and then you know, have to ship out a lot more things than you expected, and that costs money and time.
Now, you just said that the major advantage of doing on your own versus a fulfillment center is the cost of getting, of cost of not having to deal with a fulfillment center. For people who are going to approach a fulfillment center, is there like a standard rate or some examples of pricing you can give for people who may want to go that route?
Yeah, there's no real, I mean, it depends on your fulfillment center. There's some fulfillment centers that I think are very transparent with their prices. I know ShipNaked is one that is really transparent. They have all their prices online for you to see. So like getting a quote from them is really easy. You just look online. You never even need to contact them if you don't need to. I wouldn't say there's like a standard rate because everything is different. So I will say that fulfillment houses probably charge a packing fee, and that's probably built into their pricing. But, you know, fulfillment houses could be like, okay, it costs $4 for us to send anything anywhere. And that's a flat rate to pay for our time and labor, plus the shipping cost to send it to that place.
Okay.
So if you're sending out one big package with a bunch of little things in it, sure. If you're sending out a bunch of little tiny packages, that adds up.
Yes, definitely. I can just imagine doing at least small shipping on a small scale. I'm just thinking about, again, when you get to hundreds and hundreds of boxes that all have to be shipped to different places, different shipping around the world and the country, it will balloon very quickly.
A custom USB drive with Darkest Dungeon's face on it, that's great. Mm-hmm. Awesome. Let's sell it for $10. Okay, well, it costs $4 to make, and then you need to ship it. Mm-hmm. And now all of a sudden you're broke.
Yes. Now, another question regarding the Fulfillment Center, do they, as you were talking about earlier, with having different board games or different tabletop games of varying designs and how they're actually packaged and put into everything, does the Fulfillment Center handle that part of it? Like, if you tell them, we need this pack this way, will they do that for you, or do you have to do something on your end?
Well, the Fulfillment Center probably doesn't do any specific, like, product packaging. They probably just put it in a box and send it, okay. Or, you know, whatever they do. Your manufacturer can, you know, kind of organize where it fits into the box, because the Fulfillment Center gets it, and it's already shrink-wrapped.
Okay.
So.
And if you get from the manufacturer, like, they get shipped to you, the same deal. It's going to come all shrink-wrapped, all ready to be sold.
Yeah, I hope so. it depends on, nightmare stories. Mm-hmm. But it depends on what your good is. If you're just a bunch of cards, they're probably already shrink wrapped. If you're like all these little figurines, without a box, it all depends.
Okay. Now, another question, this may be a good example of a nightmare scenario, but if, like, let's say you ship something, or the Fulfillment Center ships something, and let's say it gets damaged or something happened to it during shipping, who's, I guess, responsible from it on that front? Is it the Fulfillment Center, or is it you that sort of has to hopefully fix things?
Was it damaged when it left the Fulfillment Center, or was it damaged when...
Let's say it got to the Fulfillment Center, everything's good, it got shipped, and let's say maybe it got crushed, like, on the plane, or a big bump caused things to get messed up.
Yeah, I think that's the Fulfillment Center's problem, then. So, it depends on your contract. Mm-hmm. With the Fulfillment Center, generally, you'll have a contract when you do business like this. And I'd make sure your contract had good terms in them, and one of the terms would be damages. Okay. And when you get paid, that's another good term to get. Nothing to do with any of these challenges, but make sure it's clear when and how you get paid.
Yeah. And that's a good springboard into this question. As I asked you earlier in the manufacturing section regarding what questions or things to bring to the manufacturer when you're going to deal with them, are there any other details or things that a designer should be asking or have already prepared when they start looking around at fulfillment centers?
What do you need from me? When do I get paid? What happens if there are problems such as damages or I don't get what I asked for? Mm-hmm. Making sure that it's clear and you've thought about the bad things that could happen to your specific product. So for like cards, what happens if the bleed is wrong? Or what happens if the cards are damaged? What happens if the box is damaged? What happens if you printed the wrong page of the thing? And that's where these proofs come from, and they send you proofs so that, and even sample copies, so that there's a baseline. And then if you approve that baseline, then a lot of the liability that they had is gone because you've approved something they gave you. Mm-hmm. And now if you notice later that there's a problem or a mess up, it's on your hands.
Okay. And that's actually a good point. What happens, like going back to the example of something's not right, let's say that during manufacturing, a figure in one batch of boxes got broken, or cards like the ink completely bled through, it doesn't work. And you don't find out about that until, you know, already past the fulfillment process. It's in the consumer hands and they figure it out. How do you go about, I guess, fixing that for the consumer?
Give them a new one.
Okay.
I mean, it happened with both my projects. Like, just give them a new one. There's no, like, you want your customers to be happy at the end of the line, and you'll hopefully have made so many copies that you can afford a 1 or 2% loss of goods because of that.
Okay. All right. Now I'm trying to think if there's any other parts of fulfillment to go over. Is there anything that I missed, like specifically relating to fulfillment that you want to bring up, Anthony?
Think about it earlier than you would otherwise in your project. So like, if you're even thinking about making a physical good, don't just throw up that physical good on your Kickstarter and say, yeah, you know, buttons. I just looked up how much it costs to make buttons. It costs $2. So we'll just say $5 for buttons, like plan it out, all of it.
All right.
Including fulfillment.
And actually, that's remind me of a question then. When you're dealing with the fulfillment centers and you're drawing up the contracts, like, is there like a duration that they will fulfill for you? Is it like an ongoing thing? Like, do they say, we will be your fulfillment for 12 months or a year or something like that?
So you're paying them to hold on to your product. Mm-hmm. So they'll hold on to it for as long as you pay them.
Okay.
I don't think there's any like expiry, but it's good to know what happens in those situations.
All right. So I just want to clarify. So when you're dealing with the fulfillment center, you're not only factoring in the cost of them, you know, packing, shipping it around the country, around the world, but also for them storing it as well at their warehouses?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So if I were to make a good that costs $3 to make, I would probably sell it for $10. Mm-hmm. Just because it costs $3 to make, then X dollars to ship and Y dollars to hold. Mm-hmm. And I probably would not be making money on that product for such volumes for Kickstarter. Now, if you're making like a million of them, then it doesn't cost $3 to make anymore. It probably costs 30 cents to make. And that's where you get to see your big profits. Okay. But if you're doing a side good for a digital game and it's a physical item, you're probably not selling millions of it. And if you are, you're awesome.
Yes. Now, I guess as a question to sort of tie everything together, or I guess to expand on things, let's say we are beyond the Kickstarter phase. We are at the point where you actually have your own like online shop on your site and people can buy any goods you have on there, stuff like that. When you're at this stage where you're able to actually have and support your own shop, do you start thinking about having these products like on a massive scale, like on almost an infinite scale? Or are you still thinking in terms of my online shop we stock with, let's say, 2,000 of this item, 5,000 of this item, etc.?
Yeah, if I'm at that stage, I probably know how fast I'm selling things because I have data for, you know, selling them. So I don't want to say infinite. I want to say that I would buy and rebuy based upon demand. So like if I know that my board game is going to sell out in 6 months because I sell 20 copies a day and I have 10,000 copies left, then I should probably reorder in 3 months so that it's printed and ships overseas and arrives at my fulfillment center with enough time so that I don't have a gap in sales.
Yeah.
So you would know.
Okay. And again, it goes back to the importance of understanding the logistics of everything, knowing when to start preparing. Because again, we're not one of the big differences between a physical and a digital good, obviously, is that digital goods are in the ether. You just have to type in code and it's there. There's an infinite supply. But when you're trying to manufacture a card game, a t-shirt, whatever, it's not just you hitting a button and it's there in a week. You got to get it manufactured, then shipped to either you or fulfillment, then the fulfillment has to handle it. Again, there's so many different balls to juggle and hoops to jump through to get this right.
Yeah, if I make 1,000 codes and I make 1,000 games and I only sell 500 codes and 500 games, one of those is an Excel spreadsheet. Another one of those is in my basement, just sitting there.
Yeah.
And one of them costs money to make.
Exactly. All right. I think with that, I have, I guess, a few general wrap-up questions for you, Anthony, and then we'll wrap things up for this cast.
Sure.
I guess to end things with, I guess, as an overall question, what would be one of like, the biggest things, like, overall, when you're going from all three of these stages, to keep an eye on? I know you've probably answered this throughout the cast, but to just like tie a bow or tie a ribbon around it, what would be like a big thing that someone should take away from listening to this cast?
If you're a physical game maker, There's a lot you need to think about. If you're a digital game maker, please don't make physical goods. like you could, right? Like, t-shirts are awesome and I get to wear and that's cool. And so are hats. But I would make the physical goods that fit into envelopes that you can mail from your post office. So like patches, right? That you can sew onto anything. Tattoos. If your game is all about like Jet Set Radio, like you could make like graffiti things that go on someone's wall. If your game is, I'm trying to come up with creative ideas in my head. Mm-hmm. Like if your game is Pokemon and you have to go get the badges from gyms, you could make 8 badges and they're little tiny pins and you can just put them in the mail. Like you can make physical add-ons that don't require big expensive shipping or production costs or fulfillment centers at all. Yeah. So you should think of the products that you can make as add-ons that reduce the amount of shipping costs that you have to pay and the amount of space that you have to take up. Mm-hmm. So I love those types of rewards, and those are the ones that people should try to steer towards. I think digital's the easiest way because you just email it to someone and they can customize it on any of their different products that they look at and stare at every day. Like wallpapers is amazing because now I have a phone skin or a skin on my laptop. I would say like a bulky little figurine is cute and awesome, but it also costs a headache to make.
Yeah.
And you don't have to.
Mm-hmm. And again, going back to what we were talking about earlier in the cast and what you were just referring to again, that coming up with products that fit the design of the game, that, again, maximize its use versus being huge in cost, are the best products. As you were just saying, it would be easy to say, oh, we're going to have t-shirts and hats and buttons and little figurines. They're all going to sell well. But then you have to think about manufacturing all that and shipping all that. And it can easily balloon the cost. And if a developer doesn't think about that during their Kickstarter, as you were saying a few minutes ago, like if they just come up with a product, you know, 5 days into their Kickstarter, this can easily come back to haunt them in a few months down the line when their whole cost has been eating up because of not properly doing the research.
Yeah, people can wear a t-shirt. They can wear a button, too. They could wear a little wristband that weighs like nothing and is really cheap to make.
All right. I'm trying to think quickly if there's any other questions that I have for you. And I think I am just about out of it. So are there any, like, for all three areas of making a physical good, is there anything that I missed that you would like to touch on before we say goodbye?
No, I don't think so. I mean, it's just the same thing that we talked about. Like, if you're going to make a good, try to design it with fulfillment and production and shipping in mind. Like, I could think of a ton of cool ideas, but I want to think of practical ideas when I do a Kickstarter, because Kickstarters are all about lean. Like, a lean Kickstarter is what I like the most, so that your costs are managed.
Okay, I think that was a great point to end things on. Anthony, it's definitely been a pleasure talking to you tonight. Again, physical goods is not an area that I am well-versed in, but it's definitely one that's very fascinating and obviously very challenging for someone to dive into for the first time. Do you have, like, any, like, resources? I know you mentioned a few websites earlier in the cast. Are there any other ones that people can look at for any of the three stages of making a physical good?
I like James Math. For Kickstarter stuff in general, he's great. Same with Jamie Stegmaier. Those guys are two, like, the big titans of Kickstarters for the board game space. There's a couple of really cool things that Kickstarter itself does. Like, they have Kickstarter tips on Twitter. So, like, you'll just be reading your Twitter timeline, and it's just like, oh, a Kickstarter tip. Let me see what that is. So I'd say good Kickstarters are kind of like a thing that you do over and over and kind of build it as a skill. I think a good Kickstarter is more of a craft than just a skill where you're constantly refining how you do it. So just keep learning.
Awesome. All right. With that, we're going to wrap things up here. Again, Anthony, it was great talking tonight. Hopefully we can have you back on real soon. We don't have to wait like a whole half a year to have you back.
Right. Thanks for having me back. This is great.
Yeah, not a problem. As I said, this is a very fascinating topic. It's great talking to someone who, as we've said, has had the experience, had the sleepless nights, and the nightmare stories to go along with it.
Yeah, success is too. It's not all. It's not all dark. This dungeon has some light in it.
Yep. Great. Tying it back into Darkest Dungeon too. We got that all set.
I just hope we don't lose you to that game.
I hope not too. I got work I gotta get done. I have two jobs now. I have the site and I have my temporary job. I don't have time to get lost in the Eldritch Dungeon anytime soon. I'm gonna try, but I can't make any promises.
Good luck. Yeah.
All right. So for those of you listening, thanks so much for tuning into this episode of the Perceptive Podcast. If you'd like to support Game Wisdom, we have several options always available. First, if you'd like to write a guest piece for the site or be a future podcast guest, you can find all the information and links under Submissions Wanted. I am currently in desperate need of new guests, so if you're an enthusiast, student, designer, whatever, as long as you're interested in talking about design in the industry, definitely shoot me an email. If you'd like to contribute to our Patreon campaign to secure some much-needed monthly funding, you can check me out on Patreon under Game Wisdom or by clicking the little donations banner at the top of the front page, and any donations would be greatly appreciated. And if you'd like to check out the various videos, Let's Plays, and video analysis I have up, you can find that on the Game Wisdom YouTube channel, which there is a link on the front page, as well as my Twitch stream, where I'm usually on daily, most nights at 10 Eastern under GW Bicer to watch live. So, again, thanks for tuning in to this special edition of the Perceptive Podcast. Have a great rest of the week, and we will talk to you again next time. Take care.